This is the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. My dad grew up in the Deep South, and he once told me he remembered the day in high school. It was the late 40s when his social studies teacher told the classroom, "Kids, over the next few years, you're going to be hearing the phrase civil rights a whole lot more." Turns out the social studies teacher was quite correct. Well, something about the events of the past few days suggests there's a word we'll be hearing a whole lot more in coming months, if not years. That word is nationalism. Do your own Google search, as we all do, and what you'll find is a whole lot of commentary over whether nationalism is good or bad, and anxiety over what nationalism means in practical terms. To help us explore this subject, Jeremy Suri, a professor at the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin. Jeremy, thanks for coming back in and speaking with us.
Nice to be on.
You know, since the end of World War II, there was a kind of a consensus of Western nations, I suppose, that there needed to be something that would lessen the possibility of yet another global conflict. And a lot of the thinkers, Bretton Woods, elsewhere, believed that globalism was a way to go, that
yes.
Dropping borders,
yes.
a bigger one world sort of strategy approach. A lot of people have seen the election of Donald Trump as a repudiation, not just Donald Trump, but also Brexit.
Right.
Let's talk a little bit about what this means. Back going before World War II, there was a whole movement here in the United States, the America First movement. Are we seeing a new nationalism now?
I think we are. I think, as you correctly said, David, we could argue that the period from 1945, the end of World War II, really until about 2001, until the attack on New York City and Washington, D.C. on September 11th, really for that period, for that 55, 56 years, we saw an effort by the major powers in the world to integrate smaller countries and integrate their own countries. And the argument on the liberal capitalist side was that a world of free trade, a world of capitalism, and a world of democracy would be a world that would be more peaceful and more prosperous.
People would have a stake in outcomes here.
People would have a stake, and people would see their lives improve. And even if they didn't always get their way, there was the recognition that a more global world would mean less local control, less local culture. Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, people would feel that their lives were getting better. And if their lives were getting better, they would live together peacefully. The communists made the same argument for a different kind of system
right.
on their
Absolutely.
Side. So we had two globalizing systems. And the mm-hmm. Cold War was a rivalry between these two systems. One collapsed and one succeeded. And the remarkable successes of the American-led global system are extraordinary. If you look at living standards, if you look at the ways people across the world live today, and the absence of great power war. For about 55 years. What's happened since September 11th, 2001, is you could argue the world has now gone in a different direction. And what we've seen the last 2 years with elections in Europe, including Hungary, as well as
right.
Brexit,
right.
The vote in Colombia against the peace deal, mm-hmm. And then our own election of Donald Trump, is you can see the outgrowth of about a decade now of building anger, building resentment, a building desire to get out of this global system, a desire expressed not by a majority necessarily, but by a very active group in multiple societies that believes this globalizing system is not serving their interests.
What does this new nationalism effectively mean for, well, let's talk about the United States, because I think a lot of us are wondering how this is going to play out in our own backyard. The word nationalism is certainly loaded in light of the way that we've come to understand it since the days of the Third Reich, for example.
Yes.
Is it necessarily a negative?
No, nationalism is not entirely negative. There are many positive things that come out of nationalism. Wanting to serve your country is a noble cause. Wanting to help people in other parts of your country and seeing them as part of a common economy, a common community, those are noble things.
But I think we often talk about it in chauvinistic, as in that character.
Well, the problem with nationalism, as with most concepts, is it can be misused. And oftentimes those who are what I would call hyper-nationalist will use arguments about their particular country and their particular people to exclude others and to justify violence of one kind or another. And one of the things that's happened in a world of terrorism is that our legitimate desire to make ourselves safe has allowed us to justify to ourselves using extreme violence against others, people who are different from ourselves, and bringing suspicion upon them. And you made reference before to America First, mm-hmm. which was a movement in the 1930s led largely by Charles Lindbergh,
right.
who who is a similar outside figure to American politics, a similar celebrity. Lindbergh and others made exactly this kind of argument, that a system that was coming closer together as the world was more integrating was limiting American freedom and limiting the ability of American citizens, good American citizens, to get their way. And that's a lot of what I think you're seeing today in different societies. People who feel they aren't able to compete for all kinds of reasons, it might not be their own fault, are seeking to use nationalism to justify, quite literally, building walls around themselves to try to protect themselves from international competition.
Is it possible for a liberal Western pluralist society to also be nationalistic?
Yes. So the period we talked about from 1945 to 2001 was actually a period of great American nationalism. Americans were not less nationalistic. They were more nationalistic, but they defined their national interests for the most part as being part of building an integrated world system that integrated our economy with the economies of other societies, integrated our society with other societies. And so that integrated approach matched up with nationalism. I would call that a civic nationalist approach. But there are other kinds of nationalism. We're seeing, I think, now a much more exclusive nationalist, even a racist nationalist point of view in many parts of the United States.
I think a lot of people have pointed to white nationalism and that sort of thing. But when we're talking about raising the bridges, if you will, the drawbridges to NAFTA, the Pacific Trade Agreement, and that sort of thing. A lot of people say that you don't necessarily have to go into the white nationalist front or any of those sort of fringe movements to make a pretty powerful case that maybe it's time to pull up the drawbridges, if not necessarily when it comes to immigration, but perhaps trade.
Sure, sure. So I think it depends what your argument really is. If your argument is that many of these integrative efforts, especially economic, are hurting certain groups in the United States, and that the government, out of nationalist reasons, should do things to try to protect and help those who have been hurt, that does not have to be a racist argument at all. That would be, in fact, a social welfare argument. That would be an argument for a kind of liberal nationalism. That's an argument that, in fact, was made by Franklin Roosevelt, an argument that has been made by many leaders in the United States and in Europe for the last 50 years. When, however, you say that these agreements are somehow corrupt, that they're rigged, that they're harming us all, and that to be a part of them is being a traitor to our country.
Right.
That involves almost an inevitable racial component, because you're saying there's something unique about Americans that means we shouldn't be connected to this other part of the world, even though such a high proportion of our population has a direct connection to these other parts of the world. So it's the composition of your argument, David, and how you make it.
But I can obviously see how in the coming certainly months, if not years, we begin to talk about nationalism in a different sort of light.
Right.
And I can also see this energizing people on both sides of the aisle as we struggle to define what this is.
Sure. That would be a very healthy debate to have. If we can have that debate, but we need to make sure we pull out of it or exclude from that debate many of the harmful, not just racist, but other kinds of exclusivist phrases and words that often can get polluted in that debate. It is a very fair debate to say, in a world that's becoming more integrated in economic, environmental, and various other ways, we need new kinds of policies to help people who are falling behind, to help people who don't have a chance, to preserve equality. That's actually an argument Bernie Sanders made as much as Donald Trump. That's one kind of argument. But it's another kind of argument to blame a certain group and say, the Mexicans are taking our jobs, or the Chinese are taking our jobs, and we're going to do things about that. Once you start down that road, David, you're going down a belligerent racist road.
Okay. Now, if we were to say the Belgians are taking our jobs, are we still going down the belligerent
racist
road?
I think so. Yeah. I think anytime you... there are two problems with that kind of argument, right? If you say the Belgians are taking our jobs, first of all, it's stereotyping a group. It's making them out to be evil, as if they're sitting there in Brussels and saying, we're going to take American jobs. Let's take American jobs. That's, of course, not what's happening. And secondly, it's unrealistic to presume that those jobs are leaving simply because someone else is doing something to harm us, when in fact that's the nature of the global system.
But I remember that we used to say the Japanese are taking American jobs. I mean, a lot of people would make the case that's not a per se ethnic attack. What we're talking about is the Japanese being particularly effective with a whole range of of policies, basically negotiating better deals than we were. They were more self-interested than perhaps we were in our desire to spread Western-style capitalism.
That's a fair argument to have, so long as we avoid, first of all, the anti-Japanese sentiment that was quite common in the 1980s. You might remember that, first of all. But second, if we're going to have that debate, let's have that debate less about whether they're taking our jobs or not, but much more focused on the facts. Okay, what are the deals? What are the trade deals we've negotiated? And where are we being harmed? Where are we being hurt? Here's part of the problem. Those who want to get out of these trade deals still want all the material wealth that's been produced by them.
Of course,
We're sitting here, you and I, we're wearing clothes, none of which were made in the United States. Our clothes are far less expensive, and you and I can own more of them because we have someone in Vietnam, right? Or someone in Costa Rica making our clothes. If we start making them here in the United States, we're going to have a lot less. So we have to recognize that trade has actually made us all, even those at the bottom end of the spectrum, more materially comfortable. But it's created great inequalities. And so we need to talk about how we want to perhaps rethink those deals to help those who have been left behind, but not throw the baby out with the bathwater. The problems with these kinds of arguments about the Japanese taking our jobs or the Belgians taking our jobs or the Chinese taking our jobs is that they become either-or arguments. We're not going to go back to a world without global trade. We have to manage that world better. And that's about the deals we make. It's also about the policies we have at home. I feel for many of those who voted for Donald Trump, I certainly didn't, but many of those who voted for Donald Trump who feel left behind, who feel disrespected, part of that's because we have an education system that is impenetrable to certain people. Part of that is because we haven't done things to retrain people who've lost their jobs at steel mills and
at
coal mines.
Some would make the case that we've been so eager to open, to drop these trade barriers, that we've completely forgotten about those that we knew would be left behind in the process.
I think that's right, but I would simply point out that many of those who have been advocates of free trade, not all, but many of those who have been advocates of free trade, including President Obama, have been advocates of doing more for people at home as well. And what you've had instead is you've had the beneficiaries of free trade, often in particular industries, arguing for more free trade, but then arguing to do less and spend less at home. The solution is not to make it about trade or no trade. The solution is about how to manage trade and how to help those at home to make them more competitive in a more trade world. It's sort of like if you're in a neighborhood with a lot of smart kids, you don't want to close the schools for the smart kids. You want to have a way to help your kids compete with the other kids. That's what we need to do.
Jeremy Suri is a professor at the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin, and something tells me this is, you're probably going to be back here on the broadcast, and we'll be talking about some of these issues in coming months. Jeremy, thanks so much for coming in and speaking.
Thanks for having me on. Great questions.